We made this.
Hi, this is Dean Haglund. I'm Langley from The X-Files, and you're listening to The X-Cast.
And welcome to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. My name is Kurt North and I am your host for this week. We are still on our continuing coverage of season six, and along with me are the two other showrunners. First up, it's Sarah Blair. Sarah, how are you doing?
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Early morning for you, as usual, when we record. We seem to we try and get you up as early as possible. Is it 5, 6 in the morning?
Yeah, 6 a.m. now, but I got up at 5.
Have you had your coffee?
I have.
Good.
Have my oatmeal, my porridge. Is that what you call it? Porridge.
Porridge. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's all good. That's all good. And also with me is Carl Sweeney. Hello, cutie.
Morning, both. Morning, my fellow gunmen. Good to be with you.
It's good to be with you. Sarah's tasked us with deciding who's who. So, Sarah, who do you think should be who in this?
Obviously, you should be Langley because you've got the most hair. Right? I'm kind of a hippie, so.
No, Sarah, I think you're the most lecherous of the three of us. So you're pro hickey.
I'm pro hickey.
By process of elimination, that makes me bias. I can live with that. I like bias.
Okay. Well, you're the idealist, aren't you? Which we'll come into shortly. We are talking about Three of a Kind, which is season six, episode 20. It was written by Vince Gilligan and John Shaban and directed by Brian Spicer. And this is the episode where Scully lights my fire. Absolutely, without a doubt. It's one of my favourite moments in X-Files history, this. So I'm sure we'll get there. But let's do all the usual stuff. So let's talk about the episode in general. Sarah, what are your general thoughts on this one?
I like this one. It's fun. I always like getting to spend time with the lone gunman, especially when it's just them. We don't get to see them too often. And especially not on their own. So I love those little moments between them just to see what their life is like. And so this is what they do with their time, apparently, is they go to conferences and play Dungeons and Dragons and cause general mayhem and havoc. So it's good times with the gunmen.
Good. So what would you rate out of 10 then?
Let's go with an 8. Yeah, because it's really fun to watch. It's a very watchable episode.
I would agree with that. Absolutely, yeah. It's watchable. It's definitely fun to watch. What about yourself, Carl, then? What are your thoughts on this one?
Well, okay, I would go probably more like a 6.5, I've got to say. But I do agree with Sarah. I think it is very watchable, and I think it is entertaining. For me, the lone gunmen work better in small doses. However, I think Unusual Suspects is a really good episode. That would probably be more like an 8 from me. I really like that one. I feel like this one is a decent sequel that we didn't necessarily need, but it's well done. It's quite entertaining. There are some real highlights here. You've mentioned one of them already, I think. There are a couple of really good things here. I just find it one that doesn't linger in the memory, and it would never be one that I would list as like a favorite. If, you know, I'd be writing a very long list of favorite X-Files episodes before I got to Three of a Kind. But no, 6.5, so better than... I think I gave The Beginning a 6. I think I gave Terms of Endearment a 6. But I think I enjoyed this episode more than those two, to be fair. So it's good stuff, decent stuff.
It's interesting because I'm going to go lower.
Ooh.
Yeah, I'm. It's strange, you know, I was thinking about this last night, that I've actually done the reverse of you. So as the episode
got less enthusiastic,
I'm getting less and less concerned about them. I've made a comment on The Unnatural, which to be fair, I don't know which order it comes in now, because Disney Plus in the UK has just really come out, and The Unnatural and Three of a Kind have been switched. So
mislabeled as well.
Is it right? So this is episode 20. So this on Disney Plus, this is on where The Unnatural should be, and it's called The Unnatural, but it's Three of a Kind. And then Three of a Kind's the next episode, and it's actually The Unnatural. So,
Disney, you have one job.
I know. Well, this is the thing. X-Files just gone up on Disney Plus in the UK very recently. The very first episode I go on to watch on there is labeled incorrectly. So it's kind of making me fearful to watch the rest of the series on
Which
there.
One was the one you wanted? I'm curious.
Right.
So the first one.
When you wanted to when you were about to record The Unnatural, yeah. Sarah, I thought, I'll watch The Unnatural. I might be able to drop in a comment or something on Facebook, which I never did in the end.
I was looking for your comment, Carl.
Yeah. Well, it didn't happen because when I clicked on The Unnatural, it kicked off with previously on The X-Files, and it was all about Suzanne Modesky. And I was thinking, I don't remember this.
You should have put a comment on talking about the episode then on Facebook.
Yeah. Now, obviously, I've done my X-Files fan duty, and I've reported this to Disney Plus, but it's been a whole week, I'm just saying, and they haven't done it yet. You'd think it'd be like priority one. Like, guys, there's a season 6 episode of The X-Files that's mislabeled. Let's sort that out. But nothing yet.
Yeah, so The Unnatural is last week. I hosted that, and Kathy was our guest last week, so...
Yeah, so I really like all the baseball in this episode, guys. So, yeah. Looking forward to discussing it.
What do you think about that alien?
The alien's quite tall, isn't he? He is really tall. He is really tall. So I would rate this as a 6 if we go back to what I was just about to say, because for all the things that you've said, Carl, really, the first half of the episode, when I watched it a few days ago, it was just almost like, oh, this is all right. It's fine. You know, and it was only when Scully came in that I felt, actually, this is actually uplifting, and it felt that it needed that. And as I kind of watched it again the second time around, it was a bit better. But at the same time, it was just stick on and watch it. But not in the way that the earlier episodes have been, where like Triangles and the Rankings of the like, where I would actually stick on and watch it and enjoy it. I would forget about this one to even put on. So it's... But it's perfectly acceptable as an episode. It's not a bad episode by any means. It's just kind of just there, which is interesting. So IMDb rate it at 8.1 out of 2,471 votes.
Too high.
Too high, no, Sarah?
No.
I was interested. I found the demographics for The Unnatural, and I was looking through those, and I found that it was very interesting because almost more than half of the votes were from the male demographic. And so it was heavily weighted towards the male demographic. So I'd be interested to see the weight and who voted what, because the female demographic voted the Unnatural a lot. Well, not a lot, but higher. But there were fewer women voters.
Got it. Yeah.
Right.
That doesn't surprise me. That more of the people rating stuff for men, I've got to say. I'm not shocked. I don't know why.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you don't really take that into consideration usually. But yeah, I mean, it's because The Lone Gunman, as you said at the top there, Carl, is like that they eventually get their own spin-off show, but have to have an extra couple of characters in there as well. It's not just a case of just them three. I can't remember her name now. I think it's Eve.
Eve Adele Harlow. Yeah, it's an anagram of Lee Harvey Oswald, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And obviously you've got Michael McKean recurring, and you've got, Jimmy Bond as well. So it's almost like you need that extra person in there, and as you say, in small bite sizes, it's fine. You know, the humor's quite funny. Second time round, there was moments in this episode which I thought was those few extra moments which I may have missed the first time, which I enjoyed, but it's a struggle to sustain it. So without further ado, I think we should maybe look deeper into this episode. Right, so I'm going to be absolutely honest here. I have no recollection of this opening credit scene whatsoever. I put it on and I was like, what is this? I could not remember it for the life of me. Even second time around, I was like, I can't remember this during the first original airing. It is so bizarre that it's probably the only thing that I've ever come across that I've not been, I remember that. It was just not in my memory at all. But it is interesting in itself that it's this suburban home. And both of you were on the Arcadia episode, which obviously features with that. It comes up here again. It comes up in Biogenesis trilogy. You know, and this is more of an American dream, and like you were saying, in Arcadia as well. It's interesting how this theme keeps reoccurring, Carl, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, and it's treated more elegantly here than in Arcadia, isn't it? Because in Arcadia, the point is that it's kind of undercutting some of those notions. But here, you know, you've got the nice house, you've got very lyrical music, you've got a very photogenic family that Byers's got, and obviously he goes through the yard, and there's the dog, and Suzanne is there. So it's done very nicely, isn't it? Because I actually like this teaser. I think it's one of the better things about the episode. It's filmed very effectively, all in one shot through the house. And then the moment when it's all gone and he loses it all. And yeah, I like it. I think it's a nice way to reintroduce Suzanne. I feel it's a nice way to center things again around Byers. I think you were talking just before, Kurt, about how they're maybe kind of unlikely protagonists and you need other characters and things. But I think of the trio, Byers is the one who has the most potential, I think, to spin stories around. Personally, that's what I think. So I think this is decent. Do you think it's a good teaser, Sarah?
Yes. I had a really interesting impression of it this time around because I haven't watched this episode really much during quarantine. So I thought it was really interesting to think back when it originally aired and he's talking about, you know, if Kennedy had never been shot and he would live in this idealistic world and you know, all of these great things about America. And I thought that was really interesting, you know, to put at the end of this century when we're going into this new millennium and seeing things from that perspective. And then, you know, he said that line where, my fellow citizens trust their elected officials. And I just laughed and laughed and laughed because it's just so different now. And I was just like, really? Oh, sweet Byers, if you only knew, if you only knew what would happen. Yeah. 20 years from now. So
I do admit that I had that kind of reaction as well. Mm-hmm. That they said, oh, this plays differently. You know, I mean, obviously I'm not as subjective as you are, Sarah, with it, but it's like, well, this does play out slightly differently than what it does now. And as you say, some of the things that he mentions, you know, the fact that, you know, all hopes for his country and things like that, and, you know, living an ideal world. But, you know, I mean, it's interesting in itself. I mean, because would they, you know, if he had survived, if he wasn't assassinated, I mean, would you be in that position? Is an interesting question in itself, really. It is very much an idyllic, you know, dream sequence, isn't it, really?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a Stephen King story, wasn't there, about like a time travel, 11/22/63, isn't it, about stopping the Kennedy assassination?
Yeah, it was a good show, though.
I didn't see the series, but I read the book. The book was fun.
Yeah.
No, good series, was it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, really, I really enjoyed it. Yeah, it was really good. Yeah, so we come out of the credits and we're in Las Vegas. Now, apparently, we actually are in Las Vegas. You know, some of the scenes were shot there, most of them with Lorne Gunman. Gillian Anderson didn't actually make it out there, so the stuff that's around her isn't. And there was a bit of a war between the various different casinos to get the X-Files on set. You know, which in season six, you know, and I know the film's just come out, but that's interesting in itself that, you know, they are vying for a bit of airtime and a bit of, you know, notification on the show, really, isn't it?
Mm. It is interesting. All I could think of was just before the pandemic hit, I was supposed to be going to Las Vegas.
Yeah. Like
in April, if things hadn't have turned out the way they did, I would have gone to Las Vegas and got married. So arguably I dodged a bullet, but I would have liked to have seen, I would have liked to go to a few of the casinos and stuff like that. So I was kind of pining this time.
Have you ever been before?
No, I haven't.
No. What about you, Kurt?
Nope.
No,
I've only ever been to a place called Chicago. You know, Schmalberg, Illinois is where I've been.
We watched The Lone Gunman on stage, didn't we? Introduce Unusual Suspects at X-Fest.
We did. So,
yes.
Not this episode, but I was thinking about that when I was watching the episode again. That was a very treasured memory for me.
It was. Being with you guys. Walk down the hallway together and...
They were very good. They were very good together. They had a very good rapport, didn't they? Doing the Q&A and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's Las Vegas like then, Sarah? Is it, you know, is it the playground of sin that we're told it is?
Not really. It was pretty tame. Although maybe I just didn't go to the right places. But Yeah, it's fun. It's very, very big. And just everything is an optical illusion. So it's all meant to
Desert? Just
turn on. Yeah. Well, it is weird because everything surrounding it really is the desert. And then you just come into these places and these casinos, and we stayed at the Palazzo. And, you go in there and it looks like you're inside, but it looks like you're outside with the ceilings painted like clouds. And it's just a very strange place. You feel like you're in a dream the whole time almost. It's like nothing is really real, and you just get to go hang out, and it's a strange place, but fun.
Well, pertinent to this episode, living in a dream world. Mm-hmm. What I need to know, though, Las Vegas is renowned for its gambling and all that kind of thing. How are the bars? Can I sit at the bar? Kind of improbable style, and just stay there forever. And you know where to find me then, so you'll be all right.
You do what you want when you're in Vegas. That's the whole point. But I was very, very disappointed to find out the first time that I went, they don't use coins anymore. It's all electronic.
I didn't know that.
So, yeah, I was very disappointed. I wanted to have a bucket of quarters, and I was so excited. I wanted to, sit there with my quarters and hear the clinkety clank, and it's all electronic.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's sad.
Not good.
To discover that.
So another thing as well, with it being a conference, the X-Fest actually came to my mind, when they were going through DEFCON 99, and, I know it's a defense contract thing. Welcome, defense contractors, that kind of thing. Yeah. It's like, yeah, I've been to those type of conferences before in a previous life, and I've actually been on in my work. I've actually hosted them and supported them and stuff like that. So it's been a few things that in the past year we've not been able to do, and it's like conferences. I remember them so much. So a lot of things came to mind. But Sarah, what do you think to the the inadequacies of their spying at the table? I mean, it's not exactly the best, is it?
No. They're the worst. I have that in my notes. I'm like, Byers sucks at poker. And by poker, I mean like playing the game of deception. Like, he's not that great at poker, the game, but he also sucks at just trying to, he's just so blatant about it all. So, guys, tell us everything.
Like, are you working on anything interesting? And then doesn't get an answer. Are you working on anything interesting?
Just, could you be more obvious, sweet buyers? And then Frohickey's over there like, like, come on, guys. This is not how you do it. You got to be more subtle than this. And I love the boinking. He said something about boinking. Like, that word again. Back from the 90s.
Yeah,
their vocabulary.
Yeah, there's this thing that permeates through the episode of, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, kind of thing. Where's your wife, or you brought your wife, and obviously Fletcher being there as well, is kind of like a little bit of a nod to that.
Mm. Reference to boobage as well from, was it Timmy? They talk about taking in a floor show and something about a woman who teaches you to fire machine guns and all that kind of thing. So, but yeah,
naked woman firing a machine gun. Could be any more America.
I think you're right, Kurt. That's the general thing they're going for, isn't it? That people associate with Las Vegas. I don't know why. I believe that Las Vegas has more permissive laws on things like brothels. I could be wrong, but that's what I've heard on the grapevine.
Sarah's our Las Vegas expert. So let's call her. Sarah, please report back.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's not so much Las Vegas as the state of Nevada. We'll have to contact Michelle Milbauer. She knows. Presumably. To be fair to Byers, though, Sarah, he does convince a couple of the guys with his story about the delamination. Like, Grant doesn't buy it, but the others seem to kind of take it at face value. It's just funny. He looks kind of out of place, doesn't he? But he's more manly men.
He does a good job, but he goes off book, doesn't he? Because he's got to. So that's the only thing he kind of has to try and do. And because he's doing that, it's like, oh, Byers, you've gone too far. You don't need to do that.
Yeah. Which, to be fair, he did like pull that off really well, I guess, like improvisational wise. But he didn't need to, you know. But I did like the Grant Ellis character played by Charles Rocket. He was the dad in Hocus Pocus, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. And he's got this line in that where he dresses up as Dracula for Halloween. And he says, I'm dead, Kula.
Very good.
I was thinking about that the whole time. But
don't you find Grant very unmemorable, though? Like, I didn't remember this guy at all. You were talking, Kurt, about going back to the episode, not remembering the teaser. I couldn't remember this chap, basically.
I remember him. I remember him more than the teaser. But yeah, he's very kind of stock actor, isn't he? Very kind of mundane in some ways. But yeah, I can see that. I think
that's kind of the point for his character, that they're all supposed to be these somewhat defense undercover. Like, everybody's supposed to be kind of undercover, aren't they?
But you can be kind of stock and interesting, and I found him kind of stock and forgettable. But at least that poker game, they set up the idea of the rivalry, don't they? Because Byers has the queen flush and Grant trumps him with the king flush. And then later we find out that he's involved with Suzanne, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
So he trumps him in more ways than one.
Does.
You could say that.
Could say that. I just wanted to just drop in about the fact that Frohicke's coffin. And, it's not beyond the realms of possibility. It happened in Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
So did it, though.
Pick a friend. When we come out of there, though, we've got the kind of next scene. And another thing that seems to get mentioned right through this episode, it's a nice touch, really, is Frohicke, like, points at Langley's hair and goes, this ain't Woodstock. But through the episode, they keep mentioning about the hair up until the point that we actually see him without the ponytail, which, I think is a nice little touch that they actually keep talking about it so that we get the reveal of him with short hair, which he looks quite smart, In fact, he does look great.
And there's a reference in the later scene to, go brush your hair, Michael Bolton, isn't there? And I had to look up a picture of Michael Bolton because I had no idea what he looked like. Because I know a couple of the songs. Really? Yeah, I know some of the songs from the radio, but I didn't know what the man himself looked like. So I get that reference
Michael
now.
Michael Bolton. Yeah. Oh, bless. I miss. Yeah. Oh, good stuff. Good times.
There's an early scene with Byers and Frohicke where Frohicke uses the word squirrely. And I only knew he was saying this because I put on the subtitles. Squirrely, like the animal. I always thought he was saying squirrely. And I thought it was a different word. But just because of the way Americans mispronounce the word squirrel, we're just like kind of lost in translation.
Trust me, I have problems with my R's. I don't know if it's, kind of a Norwegian thing, maybe down the ways. But I can't say things like squirrel. Yeah, I struggle to really get...
How do you say it naturally?
Squirrel.
Yeah.
That sounds the same to me.
Squirrel.
So you say it, Sarah.
Squirrel. It's meant to be squirrel.
What do you say, Sarah?
Squirrel.
A squirrel.
Squirrely. Yeah, it's squirrely.
Squirrely.
Yeah. Squirrel. Like S-Q-U-W. There's a W in there. Squirrel.
Squirrel.
Yeah, I say a squirrel.
Welcome to Phonetica's Hour.
Sarah sent something the other day. What was it about how British and American people pronounce the word water very differently?
Well, how it's English, water. English and Scottish and Welsh and everyone in all the counties of UK say water differently.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Water? Do producer, you have the T in? I would suppose you're more RP, though, aren't you, Carl?
Am I?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't think I would say that. No.
Well, how would you say water then? Because I say water.
Water. I wouldn't say water like an American would.
Yeah, it sounds different when you both say it, though.
Yeah.
To me, I can hear the difference.
Yeah.
Because you have more, Carl, you have more of an emphasis in the front part.
Yeah.
And
water.
Kurt's in the back end.
How would you pronounce the word mirror, Sarah?
Mirror.
Mirror.
Mia. That's what you said.
Mia.
Mirror.
Mia.
It's a mirror.
It's a Mia. Yeah.
A Mia.
Yeah, okay. Mia. It's a Mia. As a meerkat.
You look in the mirror.
Yeah, like a meerkat, yeah. It's called a meerkat.
Yeah.
That's how you pronounce it.
Anywho.
Riveting stuff, you guys.
Before we offend anyone else.
Let's move on from that. So the backstory is quite nice, isn't it? You mentioned that Byers is it's kind of the centerpiece for Unusual Suspects, and you know the continuing story here. Whether or not we needed one is another question, but that you know he's enamored, he's desperate to see her again. It's been 10 years as well, so the fact that they've you know this backstory of they come every single year to all around the globe or wherever they may be, just on the off chance that he'll see her again is. It's a romantic gesture, really, isn't it, Sarah?
I mean, I always liked their little romance, the idea of them. It's sweet that Byers has a crush, and he's been searching for a decade for this woman, and then she just crushes him like a grape. But, you know, whatever. Yeah. I don't think that part's sweet, but I think it's sweet of him to care so much about her and have been so concerned about what happened to her after all this time. You know, for a whole decade of pining away for her, and then he finally finds her, and then just doesn't work out, does it?
Nope.
Spoiler alert. No,
I was kind of wondering if, because at the beginning of the episode, depending on where you watch it, you get the previously on the X-Files stuff that fills you in with what happened in Unusual Suspects, then you get the teaser, which has Suzanne, and then we get this sit-down meeting with Byers and Frohickey where... you know, he's saying you basically are coming to these events to try and find her. And I wondered if it would have been better if it was a bit more implicit, you know, that maybe he, because this then is the very next scene when he does see her in slow-mo, doesn't he, in the casino. It's what we've kind of alluded to. I don't know if that story from Unusual Suspects explicitly needed a follow-up as such. I do kind of like the two of them. I like Byers the most of the gunmen. I think he's the best protagonist, like I said. I quite like her. I would have been fine if they hadn't have followed up on it, though.
Yeah, well, I think it comes from the necessity, doesn't it? Because Duchovny was obviously doing the writing and directing for The Unnatural, which led to the fact that he wasn't available to record the scenes. I mean... I'm only assuming, but I'm assuming that even I can't do this to this day. You know, we're talking 20 odd years later of putting your words together, Carl, and like of recordings that I've done and putting, Sarah, can you meet me at such and such on Zoom at this time? You know, you can't even do that nowadays, let alone then. But you know, so there is a reason why they had to write this episode. But and I think to be fair, if you know, giving it a 6 out of 10 or 6.5 and whatever, they've done an okay job for what it is. And but I don't think it needed to happen. But that's just the nature of the nature of TV at this time, isn't it? You know, we're not.
Yeah, they can't all be 10 out of 10 home run episodes. You know, I think that's true. This one is closer in tone to what will become the Lone Gunman spin-off than Unusual Suspects is, isn't it? But I think the Lone Gunman spin-off is more goofy even than this episode. And I think this episode is probably better than most of the Lone Gunman spin-off episodes, to be honest. There were a couple of good ones in there. I don't know if you've seen the series, Sarah or Kurt, but there's some really...
Ages ago.
Really...
A long time ago. Yeah.
Really rubbish stuff in there, to be honest.
I've actually copied my DVDs over onto digital, like I've done with my Millennium stuff, so I can rewatch it eventually. But I haven't started to rewatch it again. But yeah, it's a tough 13 episodes. There's some great moments in it. But yeah, and I was about to say that in this episode actually, that there is a feeling that this is edging towards it, because it's only 2 years out at this point. You know, when the episode aired, it's 1999, the episode aired. So this, and it was 2001 that the, you know, that the Lone Gunman was launched. So I don't know if that was already in the minds at that point, whether it was at a sketching out phase or not, but you're right. It definitely feels like it's more of a, you know, a Lone Gunman episode, or, you know, like a proto episode as such. But which leads me to the, what I wanted to mention during this recording was Frohickey. Throughout the X-Files, actually, as well as Longman and this episode, you know, he gets himself into some interesting spaces, doesn't he? He's quite an action man, is our Frohickey.
Yeah, you mean going up in the air then and stuff like that?
Yeah, he's in the air vent, you know, in is it Memento Mori when they're in the shoe and things like that. And I think in Three Words as well, there's moments where they're dangling down. At that point, Longman's out, so we've got a few of them. So, but yeah, he does like to, he does have the, he seems to get the action. He seems to get a lot of the action pieces.
Very much so, yeah. And I have mixed feelings about that. I think they work best in their little basement or wherever, you know, in their office, basically, when Mulder and Scully go to see them. And I think there's a big difference, isn't there, between their earliest appearances in stuff like EBE, when they're a bit more enigmatic. And I feel like we lose a bit of that as the series progresses, don't we? But from that, from time to time, it is fun to see them in the field doing stuff, isn't it, to be fair?
Yeah.
I think there's something incongruous about the sight of somebody like Frohickey doing that kind of thing, which is quite amusing. Yeah.
Every con job needs a grease man, so I mean,
yeah,
you gotta have one.
And where better to do it than Las Vegas at the end of the day, you know? So it's perfect. It's a perfect setting for them. But while we're on Frohickey, which is again these little things that actually on rewatch was like, actually that's all right, is the fact that you do get the Frohickey of old. You do get the kind of like, you know, where's the superfluous Agent Scully at one point. But you also get the stuff like he does in One Breath where, you know, get your hands off her, that she's an FBI agent, you know, and becomes quite protective. And that's that's a really sweet moment, because Frohickey, as much as he can be a bit lechy in that way, in some ways, he actually does care, and he does, like, you know, has that responsibility. And it's like, no, we don't. We need to get out of that situation. And I like that from him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's fundamentally, he's a good guy, even if there is like a salacious side to him as well. I think that's what's interesting about him as a character. Like you say, in stuff like One Breath, that's when he turns up with the flowers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very nice. And it's funny here, that scene, like, yeah, when he retrieves Scully from that situation and she's like, he says, you could be committing a federal crime just by touching her. That's a funny line.
So cute. But of course, if he, you know, not him. It doesn't apply to him. But he would never do that to Scully. I don't believe that at all. He would never take advantage like that. But he's a gentleman. So he may be, you know, like you said, a little bit salacious. But, you know, he's sweet. And he's looking out for her. And I love that little quiet little head nod. He's like, come on, just come on. And, yeah, he's really cute in this. And I really appreciate how Tom Braidwood is so comfortable with the crew, because, you know, he was the AD or production guy before. And so I think that really helped put him at ease with the rest of the guys and all of that. And I like seeing that he's just hanging out. You know, he's just there to hang out. They're not like really acting, it doesn't seem like. And he's just so natural about it. And the line when he's like, Mulder's too high profile. They don't know about Scully. Like, of course. Well, these Black Ops people would know about Scully as his partner. Like, but Mulder's too high profile. They all know him, so he can't come. We have to get Scully.
I think that's quite tenuous, but it works just about. And like Kurt has alluded to, there are reasons why they needed it not to be Mulder.
Yeah.
So I think, we can go with that. That's fine.
Yeah. This is the first episode that Mulder is neither seen nor heard in the
He's heard. Well,
he's heard.
Technically, though, it's the computer saying it.
Yeah, but it is David Duchovny. It's very funny the way that the very flat affect in his voice where he's Scully, it's 2:40, whatever the time is. 2:43.
It technically is him, but technically it's not him. It's the computer saying it.
That is true. I like the way that scene plays out, though, where he's like, the lone gunmen are on to something big. It's quite amusing.
But when Scully arrives as well, it's almost like, you know, I did put in my notes that, you know, come on, guys, you know, have a plan, because it's like his phone is the first question you'd ask is like, you know, where's Mulder? Say it straight away. And you're like, we've got everything in plan, but we haven't thought about what we're going to say to you when you arrive. Which was wonderful.
His phone's messed up. that made me laugh.
The episode, when I said there are some memorable things about the episode, of course, I think Scully is part of that, especially once she's been injected. I suppose even before that, because in that autopsy scene, I like the way Scully is just kind of normal in that scene, but I find that scene quite cringy because Langley's a bit vomiting and all that. It's so drawn out that I just find it kind of dumb.
Well, the thing with that scene for me is that it's the reflection, because it's actually quite a gruesome, quite graphic, like incision that she's doing, and it's, you know, it's really well done, and I don't think I noticed it. I knew about it, and obviously you kind of in your mind go, "Oh, I remember this scene." It was the second time watching it, I concentrated on the reflection. I was like, "That is some strong work, that, you know, to get Langley to that position." It obviously reminds me of Jose Chung's From Outer Space, of course. But much more dramatically done, in the fact that he tries his best. He does try his best.
And when she says, "Pass me the striker saw," that was kind of funny too. I like that.
He's just I was gonna ask, what do you guys think about the three guys? They're almost like the opposites of the mirror image of the lone gunman when they all kind of meet up and face off together. Jimmy and Timmy, and do we ever get the other guy's name? I can't remember. And it was Jimmy and Timmy.
Jimmy, Timmy.
Well,
and Kimmy.
No, isn't Kimmy in the Lone Gunman spinoff? Isn't that they have Jimmy's brother? Because don't you remember? Is that right, Kurt? I can't remember.
I honestly can't remember.
I think his brother is there, played by the same actor, and he's called, I believe it's Kimmy. I found him quite grating, to be honest.
Yeah,
Sarah.
I did too. I didn't like them much, but I think that's the point. They're not supposed to be likable. We're supposed to like the lone gunman, and these guys are supposed to be more antagonistic. And
post 2001, I have kind of a different reflection on it, because the actor who's playing the CIA agent is John Billingsley, and he was in Star Trek Enterprise as the Doctor in Star Trek Enterprise. So, you know, he's quite a well known actor in that.
He's been in a lot of things, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
seen him other places.
So he's, you know, I talk about stunt casting, but it had a particular resonance for me being a Star Trek fan. So I was like, oh, you know, it's jump. I wouldn't have got it right at the time because it was 2 years before Enterprise had started. But you always like focus on that now. It's like, I'm more focused on him more than anything else, really. But I do like the fact that they're the ones, that those three are the ones that find out he's the imposter. You know, it's not the lone gunman that find that out. And you know, when he turns around and looks in the camera looking at Medeski in that DEFCON conference, I thought that was a nice touch that they actually had them do that rather than the gunman.
Can we talk a bit more about Scully? Because one line that I really like is when she's with all the men around her and Frohickey turns up. We've already talked about that scene a little bit, but the line I really like is when she says, "I like Hickey." You know, the way she says all the lines when she's in that, you know, it's got the side effects.
Yeah.
Very funny.
Well, this is what I was alluding to before. I mean, this for me is prime Gillian Anderson. Why she's not being picked in more comedies, I don't know, because, you know, a timing in this, you know, from the scene we were talking about before, which is the Langley stuff, and she's trying to push it, and, she, you know, she says, "Hi, cutie," at that point, and, you know,
that's very good. Yeah.
You know, oh man! I mean, we
could rhyme them all off. You know, it's because it's that because they're that that brilliant. And as you say, the kind of light my fire bit, and you know, I don't know who lights my fire.
Getting her own back on Maurice Fletcher as well.
Yeah,
which is fun.
And the way she pulls that cigarette out is like, you know, I mean, I know she was a smoker anyway, but it's like, yeah. That's fine by me. I'm all right with that. but I do everything, even like the tickling as well. I mean, it's just like every scene that she's in that state is faultless, absolutely faultless.
Yeah, like the reaction shots when they get her back to the room and Suzanne's there. They're very funny too. It does liven up the episode. I think without that element, we'd be all giving this episode a lower score, I'd imagine, because there'd be just much less to recommend about it.
Yeah. Well, I was going for a 5 with Gillian Anderson's portrayal, it was a six because of that. That's what pushed it.
I think that's fair. Pushes it up, yeah. Definitely.
Kathy also mentioned that part where, you know, she's sitting on the bed and Suzanne Modesky gives her the injection and she says, oh, just a little prick. Kathy pointed out to me last night, we were talking, and in Blood, back in season two, there's a commercial on the television where they're sending out this message to the people saying, oh, you should get your cholesterol checked. It's just a little prick. And they say that phrase. And so we were trying to, I'm pretty sure it's Vince Gilligan calling back to that episode. It makes sense that he would. And that subtle little hint there. So I thought that was cool she noticed that.
The only slight criticism that I have around that scene is that some of the ADR work isn't great when it's the back of Scully's head, where she's like, there's a few moments where it's like, you can tell it's not her saying anything or doing anything, but they've put like additional dialogue in there, you know, just like hee 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 and stuff like that. But everything,
I love her laugh so much.
Everything like, well, that's the thing as well. I mean, that was something I actually didn't write down, but I wanted to mention, and I completely forgot about, is Frohickey hears the laugh. And when you hear the laugh, I just automatically, in some ways, takes me out, but I don't care. It's Gillian Anderson, you know, that's Gillian Anderson's laugh. Unequivocally Gillian Anderson's laugh. And it's interesting that Frohickey recognizes it. So at some point in my headcanon, that they've heard her laugh like that. You know, and it's not something that you would hear Scully do normally.
Yeah, I love that. But I mean, I do. Yes, it's Gillian Anderson's laugh, but I mean, it's Scully. Like, she is Scully. So, of course, it's going to be her laugh. And she doesn't get to laugh that much on screen as Scully. So maybe it is how Scully laughs. We don't really get to know that much. But yeah, I just love the way she, and the physical comedy when she's trying to push the gurney in the autopsy suite just reminded me so much of Lucille Ball. And she's like, how does this work? And she's like half drunk saying it. Like, she's never done this a million times without thinking. It should be muscle memory for her. And she's just like, I don't know. And then she just falls down. It's the best. It's so funny. She just does it brilliant.
She does. She's incredible. Really, really good. What about Byers and Modesky's story? Because Byers goes to the room eventually and confronts her and believes that she's being brainwashed. It's an interesting scene that it's, as you say, it's a continuation on the premise on Unusual Suspects, but also that, you know, that he's caring that much and she's like just completely dismisses him, and to the point of, like, you know, in some way trying to protect him. And that will reverse at the end of the episode where it's like, I'm still going to fight. And, you know, he basically says, no, we'll do that for you. So you've done your bit kind of thing. It's an interesting dynamic between the two of them. And, you know, the fight between and the internal struggle between about who's going to protect who is a nice little moment, really.
Yeah, I think it's better that way than if it had been, you know, he's going to rescue her and that is what had actually happened. I think it's more effective if Suzanne has a bit more autonomy and there's more to it than that. So I do quite like it, to be fair. At the same time, a lot of these scenes, there's nothing wrong with them per se. I can't say I'm exactly on the edge of my seat as they play out, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just don't feel much tension from the scenario. And although I like them two together, I don't care about them enough to be really riveted.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm.
What about you, Sarah?
Yeah. I mean, as much as I like the idea of having the story, it doesn't really compel me to want more after this. You know, like, I didn't really miss any of it between Unusual Suspects and here. It wasn't something I was constantly thinking, like, oh gosh, is Byers going to find Suzanne Modesky? Like, what's happening with that plot line? Is she ever going to happen again? You know, will she ever show up again? I don't know. So it's not something that I was thinking about until now, but yeah. And also, I thought it was interesting that she was in room 1066 which is when the Battle of Hastings happened and William the Conqueror took over England and brought in the Norman conquest of all that. So I don't think that has anything to do with anything.
No,
but
I was wondering that. Cause
yeah.
I wondered that too. And I looked up 1066 to see if there was anything else going on that would make it a more obvious reference. And I couldn't find anything. I think it was all happening in England in 1066. That was the main, you know.
Yeah.
I can't see how that would map onto this episode, mm-hmm. but can you?
No.
No, because the opening, the house as well is 1057, and I wasn't sure if that was something. I thought obviously made the same connection, 1066, but I was like, there's a couple of numbers, like 1044 as well. So I wasn't sure mm-hmm. if it was like they are trying to pin something together or not, but I didn't bother to look because I wasn't
Maybe it
really
was just in Vince Gilligan's head.
Yeah.
Just like, I need a number. Oh, 1066. That sounds familiar. Something.
just throw that in.
Let's just throw that in. But, or probably the production. Probably not even Vince Gilligan, is probably the production crew just having a laugh or needing a number.
I mean, I think there are some references in the episode that we could touch on. You mentioned the reference to Mata Hari, of course, mm-hmm. Sarah.
Yeah.
I think that's alluded to. She's alluded to a couple of times, isn't she?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He calls her Mata Hari a few times.
Yeah.
Which, that was a tragedy. So,
you
know. Yeah, do you know the story of her?
Only the sort of the bare basics, really. Yeah. So some people still think she was wrongly accused. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, according to Drunk History, which is where I got my information.
which What's is that, a podcast
very,
or?
No, it's a show. I'll have to send you the clip. It's very funny. So if you don't know, I don't know if you're not familiar with it, where it's a Comedy Central show and they have comedians get, like,
we've got a version
slammed.
Of it here. We have got a version of it here. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
They get them slammed and then they tell these stories and then they have actors act out the words that they say while they're drunk. It's very funny.
Is it funnier than Saturday Night Live? Because yes. Sarah keeps sending us Saturday Night Live clips and me and Kurt are just completely deadpan.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. But there's a part where in this particular episode, she is explaining how Mata Hari came to France, to Paris, and she was like, she calls her the grandmother of the striptease. And so, you know, she had this idea to do this dance, you know, and strip basically in front of an audience and call it art. And she is like, like, yeah, she stripped down to her nitties, and they're like, nitties, what are those? And she's like, well, it's like titties, but with a little bit covered up. So anyways, yeah.
I was hoping we get into like sort of quarter length trouser conversations there.
But Mata Hari, she basically just was approached by the Germans to be a spy, and she needed money, so she took their money. But she wasn't a spy. She didn't know what she was doing. And then this other guy in France wanted, like, paid her to be a spy to the Germans in World War I, that he was secretly wanting to, like, prosecute somebody for being a spy to, like, take the heat off of what turned out to be himself, because he was, in fact, a spy. And she ended up going under trial and being executed for being a spy or like a double agent type thing. But it was really the guy that put her under trial to begin with, that he was the spy and he wanted to try to take the heat off of himself. So.
And then I suppose played on film by people like Greta Garbo. So I think quite a common pop culture reference, I think, Mata Hari. And you have parallels with the Manchurian Candidate here, with like Langley being sent in.
Yeah.
To shoot Suzanne potentially at the conference. And that scene is quite a good one, I think, where we later find out he's been cured and he's not actually planning to kill her. But it's shot like the scene in The Terminator in the nightclub. I don't know if you remember where Sarah Connor's in the nightclub and Arnie's closing in on her and you get slow-mo and he draws a gun and all that. I think that scene in Three of a Kind is modelled on The Terminator. That was quite fun.
It does, yeah.
I mean, there's some stuff.
There's something I wanted to pick up as well. I mean, you're right with the Langley stuff. I liked some of the micro expressions that Modesky has, that, you know, that she knows at this point what's going to happen because she's got the blood sacks and whatever. But there's a few moments of, like, if you watch it back, you can see, ah, well, she knows what she's doing here. But I just wanted to pick out something that she, Modesky says in the room, because she says, there's a line where it says, they did things to me and it was like drowning every day underwater, struggling to breathe. And one day a hand broke the surface, reached down and pulled me up. I wanted it to be you. And the next thing after that, she started to talk about the project. I didn't trust him for years, not until he realized that he was working against them in his own way, stalling them, sabotaging them. And he reminded me of you, which has allusions to another project that might have just finished and just around the corner. It seems very similar to a story that we might have already had.
So you're talking about colonization,
yeah,
and the fact that just the idea of working on the inside and all that.
It landed on me at that point. I was like, that's, you know, the fact that they're stalling them and stuff like that. And, you know, it just felt very kind of like stock, you know, this is the project. This is kind of what we've been talking about for a while, but that's now finished kind of thing. Which in itself was quite good. But yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything else that I've missed that's jumping out at you at all.
For me, not massively, because when you get to like the stuff between Suzanne and Grant, I feel like I just couldn't care less, basically. when Timmy comes in and shoots Grant, you know, who cares, you know? What I mean is it all seems a bit low intensity and just a bit blah, yeah, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine. It's acceptable. It's watchable. It's not endlessly compelling, you know? I suppose it's quite a nice scene at the end with Byers and Suzanne, isn't it? Where she wants him to come with her.
Yeah.
Would it have been nice to see her incorporated into the series potentially, or would it have been nice for him to take this opportunity to go off with her? Or are we glad that it kind of stayed status quo, basically, with the gunmen?
I think it works the way it's done, purely, yeah, because just from the story point of view of, like, she's done her bit now. You know, she's endured this thing for so many years now that she tried to break it out. She's had 10 years, you know, had a trust broken again, that the only person that she can really trust is him. But then he wants to take on the quest as such. And it would have been nice to maybe have that quest, you know, portrayed a little bit in The Lone Gunman, potentially, if that was to the way they were going to go. I like the fact that he gets the ring, which is obviously, you know, back to the beginning of the episode. It kind of bookends that. Yeah. That's a nice touch. So yeah, I think I like it the way it ends. It's a nice little ending, and obviously they're going off to play on the slots, which is great. But yeah, I mean, I'm the same as you with the rest of the episode. Most of it's kind of like, all right, even when, you know, like sort of, you know, Timmy goes into the room and just keeps Susan alive. It's like, why are you doing that? Why are you revealing yourself to Longwind? Doesn't make any sense. You know, and only for him to get injected as well, and for him to be the culprit at the end. So it is a bit like, all right, okay, that's been done. You know, it's a difficult one in that respect, that the story itself isn't particularly engaging as such. And you're there really for the Lone Gunman and Scully, and, you know, and that's probably why I rate it 6, is kind of just in that way. What about you, Sarah? What do you think to the end?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like a deflated balloon at the end, you know, because you got the very exciting part where she gets shot and you're like, oh, and that's the big climax. And then you find out, like, oh, it wasn't for real. And then you have, like, this conversation, like Carl said, you just don't really care that much at that point. You just want to get back to Scully and see her reaction. And I do enjoy when she finally gets to talk to the real Mulder, and she's like, yeah, I'm going to kick their asses.
Kick their asses. Yeah.
Well, they keep saying that through the episode, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was a nice touch to bring that back, because Rohickey said it a couple of times before, she's really going to kick our asses. Like, and I was sort of sad that I didn't get to see her kick their asses. That would have been a much more fun. But I do appreciate that they kept the Lone Gunman. Excuse me. I do appreciate they kept the Lone Gunman together, because you can't break up the Three Musketeers. You know, they're one for all and all for one. They got to stick together. So, you know, it was necessary for him to say goodbye, but to her.
I think on that spin-off series, it would have been nice to see Suzanne at some point. And maybe if it had gone to a second season, you would have, potentially. That might have given it a bit more weight. But as we've said, it kind of goes in a different direction when you've got them like looking after babies and stuff. And
yeah,
just weird. Dancing the tango. That was actually a good episode, the tango episode, to be fair. but yeah, it gets a bit more sort of silly and absurd, the series. Yeah. So maybe it wouldn't have fit. I don't know. I would have liked to have seen her in that context.
Yeah, it becomes
it's worth checking out, Sarah, if you haven't seen it for a while, because there's an episode with Skinner. Mulder makes a cameo appearance, doesn't he? I don't think Scully ever does she? I
don't think so. No, it's just Mulder and Skinner.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
So it's worth seeing for those reasons, I think. Yeah.
Right, okay. So I don't think if we've got nothing else, should we go into the mailbag? Anyone else want to say anything? Or should we just delve in to the mailbag? Sarah? Dive in?
Let's dive in.
Okay, so a few comments on the mailbag this week. Not as many as your Arcadia one, but you know, what can you do? So Kathy says, Kathy Glinsky, shining performance from Gillian. Every moment from her is truly delightful. She elevates the meh story to a can't miss episode, and I think that's what we've basically said, isn't it? Really, it's you know, she does elevate the episode. She comes in around 22 minutes, and you know, as soon as she comes in, it just lightens it up completely, and it's you know, much easier to watch. Tony Black has said, it's incredibly forgettable, isn't it? I've seen it about half a dozen times probably, and I have to strain to recall big chunks of it. Nowhere near as close as good as The Unusual Suspects, but it's fine. As a middle of the road, as the show gets in many respects, which is surprising for what is a format breaker designed to highlight supporting characters. It perhaps shows just how reliant The X-Files was in reality to the two leads. I mean, what's the moment everyone remembers from this? Yep. Drunk Scully says it all, really. And that's an interesting thing in itself, because it's something that I like a lot of the stories that are outside of Mulder and Scully. This one doesn't really attain it. I actually really like Travelers a lot. And I don't mind some of the episodes that don't have them in as much. I mean, Unnatural, we've talked about a couple of times. It's not particularly a favourite of mine, and it doesn't really get to what I want. But it is interesting that it's more of a vehicle for Mulder and Scully most of the times, and this one just falls flat because of that, really.
Yeah, at a time when, because The X-Files in its day, of course, was, you know, very cool and seen as a groundbreaking series and all of that. But if you look sort of slightly before it, a lot of the big series that were comparable in terms of esteem had big ensemble casts, you know, things like Twin Peaks, Hill Street Blues, you know, you've got things like ER around this time, aren't you? And they're very different beasts to The X-Files. But The X-Files is more reliant, of course, on its main duo. But it does have a good ensemble too, doesn't it? Because like Euchre, I wouldn't necessarily hold this up as a great example. But some of those episodes that are about Skinner or Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man, I find them very interesting. But I think it depends which fans you speak to, doesn't it? Like, there are some fans who just aren't into a lot of those subsidiary episodes. I would have liked them to maybe test it out a bit further. Have a Krychek-centered episode. Have a Spender-centric episode. I would have been on board for it, but I think it would have been risky also, so I don't know.
It would have been. I think Krychek, if anyone would be able to have a spin-off, you still have that Skinner and Krychek aspect, which would have been nice to play a bit more on, which will lead me into Sarah asking, you know, what do you think to extracurricular episodes? Maybe starring a bald man.
Yeah, I mean, we still have to write our show, Kurt. but yeah, I think the Lone Gunmen as a unit work best when they have a fourth person to play off of and to react to them and their antics as we as the audience would react, which, you know, it just makes it a little bit more fun, I think, and it adds to their dynamic. But as far as, you know, not spin-off episodes, but like you said, the extra episodes, I would love to see a Krychek-centered episode. I always really enjoyed the Krychek-Marita storyline, and I would have loved to have gotten some more of that, because I felt like there was a lot of really rich storytelling that could come from that. between them.
Well, I think I've been open in that, you know, post-season mm-hmm. seven. That's kind of where I thought it was going. And it obviously didn't go that way. But I would have really enjoyed that element if they had Marita and Krychek in more of a role moving into season eight, really. But we went a different way and we got Doggett. So, you know, I'm not saying it was a bad choice in the end, but it still would have been nice to have that, you know, and they could have built upon that. So we've got Adam Silver says, yeah, I think this one is underrated, apparently. Had the Lone Gunman spin-off stuck to this tone instead of going goofier, I think it would have worked. He's alluding to the TV show. Carl, you've mentioned the Lone Gunman a couple of times now with the actual 13-episode show. Do you think that adding a bit more credence to more dramatic rather than comedic, it would have worked as a show?
I think the problem is that some of the writers who were writing for it weren't funny. they were trying to write comedy episodes that didn't really work. So it would have played to their strengths potentially a bit more if it had been a bit more dramatic. And it wouldn't have been as dramatic as the parent series, The X-Files. But yeah, I think Adam's got a point. It's hard to know.
Yeah.
It's kind of unprovable. But yeah, when you see like Langley being urinated on by like an infant, you think like, does this need to exist? Or I think it was Langley. It was one of them anyway.
Oh man, that happened, huh?
Well, we'll be covering it on the podcast, I think, eventually. When we get to the chronologically, it's season eight, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
look forward to that, Sez.
Can't wait. so excited.
Nicole Wilson Ripson says, I love this ep. I'm especially tickled by Michael McKean's Morris Fletcher cameo. Langley and Scully interacting is a highlight for me. I'd love more Mulder in the ep, but I understand the whole reason for the ep was needed to free up Duchovny's time for him to work on The Unnatural. So Langley and Scully, that we briefly talked about that, but it is a great moment for those two to be together. I mean, if you look, you know, post this and we get this, for example, that obviously Langley's the only one that comes back, but it is on top of the comedic aspect, on top of, you know, the seeing the glasses and stuff like that, their interaction is really solid. And I actually really like it as well. So definitely.
And I suppose it's unusual to see them interact without the other characters present, isn't it? So there's a bit of novelty to it as well.
Yeah.
Do we get Scully and Byers one-on-one? Ever? I know we get Frohickey and Scully, and we get Langley and Scully one-on-one, but I don't remember Byers and Scully one-on-one before.
I'm drawing a blank. Can you remember, Kurt?
I don't think so. I think it's a struggle to think of them very much one-on-one at any point. Mm-hmm. They're very, so very rarely split up, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even like later seasons where, you know, you've got them in the van, obviously post, you know, the show, that the fact that they've got that van, you know, there always seem to be together, so it's a difficult one. But I do like the Langley Scully thing. I do think it works really well. And Byers, strangely enough, seems to be the one missing, but is forefront in these type of episodes. So it's, you know, Frohickey and Langley seem to support more of the X-Files as much, and Byers is more forefront because of the storyline that he was given in Unusual Suspects. So that's good in itself. Christine Pons says that I love The Lone Gunman, but I never enjoyed their solo episodes, even less their series. I feel like after season six, they didn't know what to do with the characters. I think we've alluded to it with the comedic aspect in the show, but and you mentioned season eight because they kind of, you may, and even EBE early doors, they kind of have that like really grounded aspect in EBE, and then it's slowly developing this comedic aspect. But after that, it just kind of falls off a cliff a little bit.
Well, in EBE, if I recall correctly, they're actually kind of teasing Mulder a bit. You know, Mulder is actually the figure of fun. And that doesn't seem to happen much afterwards, does it? It kind of becomes inverted that they're not, you know, doling out the insults. They're kind of receiving them. They're very different characters by this point to the characters that Glenn Morgan and James Wong first wrote, I think. Because I think Morgan and Wong wrote their first, at least the first couple of appearances, didn't they? But I think a lot of fans like that. I think a lot of fans like them when they get a bit more cuddly and comedic, don't they? So, fair play.
Sarah?
I don't. I prefer them earlier.
I just think they're fun when they show up. And you know, it's they're there to they're the whole point of the Lone Gunman is to help provide information when they need it. Yeah. So, you know, they serve that purpose and they do it in a fun way. And so anything more than that, don't really need them, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, so. Talk about serving serving the story as such. Andrew Levitt says, an episode that has risen in my ranking of the last rewatch. There's some great moments of comedy here. The interaction between Gunman and Jimmy and Timmy, go brush your hair, Michael Bolton, is a classic line. Langley getting queasy when helping Scully with Jimmy autopsy. Drunk Scully's opinion of what happened to Jimmy and the way Drunk Scully reacts to Morris Fletcher and later the Gunman. Also, the opening act one with Byers playing cards to infiltrate the group is great, but somewhat reminiscent of their scenes in Memento Mori and showing that they could almost pull a successful operation. While I appreciate Byers still yearning to encounter Suzanne Modesky all these years, it doesn't really fit with the rest of his appearances in the interim. Further, the main storyline is lacking in momentum and emotional power, like Unusual Suspects. A fun romp, but hardly the show at its best. 7 out of 10 from me. That Memento Mori, this is the, I think, kind of what I was alluding to before with the whole them in action scene mode where they try to become that more ensemble piece of, you know, supporting four mode, or getting them into venues, because in EBE, you mentioned EBE, it's just they get a pass, don't they, and that's it to get in. Whereas later seasons, Memento Mori, they're actively engaged in breaking him into places.
Yeah. Well, also Fight the Future. There's the scene where they get Mulder out of the hospital very smoothly. But that was Mulder's idea, right? And Skinner helped. So I think Mulder and Skinner are working together to, like, plan the operation, so to speak, and just telling the Lone Gunman what to do helped that probably go more smoothly. But, I mean, it was a nice little con that they pulled off, so, and it was effective.
And I think that's probably the where, thinking what Andrew said there, is where I feel that they could have been that support ensemble, you know, with things like that, could have been the knowledge. I know you've fallen into like CSI kind of ensemble territory at that point, you know, you've got your techs at a certain place, or breaking them into places or opening, but that feels more natural to them. That feels more natural to them than as I say, the comedic aspects of it. And that's the way I feel with it, really. I think he's hit the right kind of vein there. That feels to me like the way that they could have gone, but still use them sparingly as well. I wouldn't want to use them every week.
Yeah, I just don't think the idea of spinning them off as well was necessarily the wisest. I think there are other characters in the series who you could have done a more viable spin-off with, or a more worthwhile series with, like Skinner potentially, or Krycek and Marita. And I think also by the time it actually happened, it was probably a bit too late, wasn't it, in terms of people actually being interested. So it was just a bit ill-fated in various ways. But I would say again that any listeners who haven't seen the Lone Gunman series, and if you can find it cheaply, which I imagine you probably can these days, there are a few episodes that are worth at least a look, aren't there?
Yeah.
It's just they're a minority, I think.
Yeah, and it's only 13 episodes. It's not as if you have to go, you know, and spend too much time with it. You will find some good stuff in there.
And I think you'll understand why Langley turns up with blue paint on his face in Nothing Important Happened Today, won't you? Because that's from the Lone Gunman series.
I always forget that. And the kind of, it's a throwaway line, isn't it? But it was a nice little nod that, actually. I like when that happens, and you don't really necessarily need to know. It's just a moot point, really. But the fact that they've put that in there to link the two episodes, the episodes together, is really nice. And finally, I just wanted to mention Chris Henry, because he's in support of the series as well. So another episode I've always enjoyed, definitely not as strong as Unusual Suspects. I'm guessing he said Three of a Kind there, but a pretty good follow-up. I'm probably one of the few people who enjoyed the Lone Gunman series. And that's the last of the mailbag. Sorry if we didn't get through to your comment this week. But any final thoughts before we sign off and head into next week?
Not really, just that this is the last episode that we're doing, because of Trio, isn't it? Before we're going to reunite, we're going to do like a season 6 wrap-up, aren't we? Where we go down the list of favourites, least favourites, and do the mailbag. But I've enjoyed the few that we've done together this season, starting with the beginning, of course. Yeah. Looking forward to the next time.
I can't believe the season's... We're already at the end. I know. Almost. Yeah. It happened fast.
I've gone really quick.
But it's been a really good season. I've really enjoyed listening to everybody else's analysis this season, and I feel like we've gotten to go really in-depth with a lot of these episodes that I know they've been kind of experimental, but I think that lends to some really fun discussion. Mm-hmm. So it's been great to analyze this season with you guys.
Yeah, it has. And it's, as I say, the wrap-up is going to be nice. And it's going to be an interesting, you know, to kind of dig down into what we think of the season and, you know, where our differences lie. You know, I'd say we've had a bit of a flip reversal of Carl and I with the season, which is quite strange, yeah. which is good to know. Field trip, Carl, you're doing field trip, is that right?
Yes, at the time of recording this episode, I'm about a week away from recording field trip, hopefully with Caradwen and Michelle, Caradwen Foley, Michelle Milbauer. So I'm looking forward to that one because I really like field trip. I think that's a very good episode. And then Biogenesis, I think, will be myself and Darren, hopefully. Always good to speak to him. So, yeah, I'm excited. And I'm excited to hear some of the episodes that I know, like, you guys have recorded. Like, Sarah's just recorded The Unnatural, but I haven't heard it yet. And Milagro as well. So it's very cool. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. I've yet to watch Milagro. That's probably next on my rewatch.
That was a fun talk.
Because I've been watching
it.
So I'm looking forward to watching that and listening to that episode. I recently did Trevor with Luke Winch, mm-hmm. which is nice to have Luke on the show. It's all coming together. Looking forward to wrapping up season 6 and start planning for season 7. That's the next thing we need to be doing. So, yeah, we'll be through the show before too long, you know. So, but while people are still here, still listening to us, you know, rattle on, where can people find Sarah online?
You can find me on Twitter at Sarah L. Blair, and I'm on Instagram at author.sarah.blair. You can find my books online, write the Tides of Darkness series, which I think X-Files fans will enjoy having a look at. So, yeah.
Good stuff. Carl, where can people find you online? What are you up to?
Not up to much, really. But I'm on Twitter at CKJ Sweeney. Haven't been using Twitter as much recently, actually. But, you can find me there. I'm on Facebook in the X-Files basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, which is still ticking over nicely. And it's always nice when people chip into things like the mailbag or whatever. Some of the polls are fun there as well. And
yeah. Well, you recently put the What I Want to Believe question up there. You watched that, and I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that was actually, I think, yesterday as we record. I'd rewatched I Want to Believe just on a whim because it's in on Disney Plus, and I thought, well, let's give it another go. It's a film... Well, we'll talk about it one day in depth, won't we? But it's a film that has risen in my estimation quite steadily since I first saw it and was a bit nonplussed. I like it much more each time I see it, basically. So it's aging well. If anyone hasn't seen I Want to Believe for a while, check it out, I would say.
What's Facebook? Yeah.
Facebook. What? Facebook is a social media platform, Sarah, which you never...
I haven't heard of it.
Oh, very rarely.
I'm not on there.
Yeah, I've heard you called it many things, but not repeatable on
there. I saw somebody posting recently about the way different things go down on social media, and it was about, like, if you posted that you'd made a cake, how it would go down differently on, like, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. So, like, if you posted on Facebook that I've made a cake, you'd get somebody replying saying... well, my cake is better than yours and my children are more perfect, basically. If you post it on Instagram, you'll get people saying, this cake is amazing, inspirational. And if you post that I've made a cake on Twitter, people would say, by posting this picture of a cake, you're promoting unhealthy behaviors, basically. And there's something to it. The social media platforms are very different, aren't they, Sarah? So I can understand.
Yeah.
Well, you can find me on Twitter. at R. Muldrake. It's R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E. Again, at time of recording, I've just covered the finale of the WandaVision on Podcast 616, so I've now flown out of there. But if you want to, if you have been watching WandaVision, by all means, come and listen to our coverage on that on Podcast 616. You can find me on Red Dwarf Podcast at Red Dwarf Pod, which is Shipwrecked and Comatose. We've currently about to release season 4 for that, and just planning to record season 5. And then The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast in which we're just about to complete season 3 of that. And you can find that at The Time Is Now pod. But thank you both for coming on and joining me this morning. It's been a wonderful discussion. I've got to go to work in an hour, so that's fun for me. But yeah, we'll see us all at the end of the season. Have fun, Carl, on the next couple of episodes.
Yep. We'll do. Elsewhere.
And we remember, this. Until next time, everyone, trust no one.
Free with this month's issue.
If you think about the band name, they didn't even commit to being good themselves, like, because Warm Jets is pretty shit.
Yeah, but it's Here Come the Warm Jets by Brian Eno is where they got it from, which is a fucking brilliant album.
Like, trying to do a rock band, naming yourself after a fucking ambient album.
No, that's it's a glam rock album.
Oh, is it?
It's not one of his ambient ones.
Yeah. All right,
he's got Babies on Fire on it and stuff like that.
Fair enough, then. I still don't think being like, oh, we're the Warm Jets, like, okay, cool.
It's not an exciting name.
That sounds like someone pissing on you in the swimming baths, isn't it? What is that Warm Jet?
Wow.
Oh, it's piss.
Some people are into that, Ian.
I know. Not in the swimming baths, though, right? That's a bit invasive.
It will get you banned from Atherstone Leisure Centre, absolutely.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
How is it tiring that we've sat on our arses and watched something on a PC screen? But it really fucking is, isn't it?
Yeah, it was full on. It's full on. Fully enjoyable, but full on, yes, absolutely.
We haven't told people what we're reviewing yet, have we?
No, we haven't, because, you know, that's why I'm edging around what we're talking about.
We're talking about the Hollyhop online Red Dwarf convention, which we both attended. And I tell you what, Kurt, I've had a bloody lovely weekend.
Yeah, it's been great. I've really enjoyed it. You know, it's, as you say, the first day was hard because they've crammed a lot in the first day. Second day, overall, because I think it's been a bit more like a Sunday, because it's a Saturday, Sunday, the recording.
We Buy Records.
Eric Clapton and Van Morrison have released an anti-lockdown song. How do you think about this? Where does this sit on the shitometer?
I think it redefines the shitometer.
Right.
I just, you know, I mean, so I think it's raising money for musicians who are affected by the lockdown and the lack of gigs, etc. Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing.
Yep.
But then you see Van Morrison and Eric Clapton, a bad thing. So,
right.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, I love Van Morrison's music. I don't particularly like Eric Clapton's music. I quite like the 60s stuff. But, they're a couple of whinging old men, aren't they? Old man babies complaining that they can't go and lick whoever they want.
Ooh.
I know. But that's what they're singing about, I think. I haven't checked that. I assume that the lyrics are about...
You can take it as read that I haven't heard it.
It's not likely to have a banging donk on it, is it?
It's unlikely to have a banging donk.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at @wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.